I'm just going to test. Can everybody hear me all right or not? Yes? Well, that's good. My husband always complains that I'm too soft-spoken. He can't hear me. And I tell him, you have a hearing problem. It was all that blasting rock and roll when we were younger. So we went to an audiologist, and it turns out he really can't hear me. So... thank you very much for having me. I'm happy and honored to be here again. I was actually here in August. Donald Rothberg gave a day-long... Oh, thanks. Am I already over time? this could be serious. I came down for Donald Rothberg's day-long on cultivating wise speech, and it's really wonderful. I'm grateful to this Sangha for supporting that kind of activity. I learned a lot that day. It was really gratifying to see how many people had turned out. You know, there must have been 55 people that day, and that there was that much interest in wise speech was... made me very happy because of my own focus on right speech and because of the time I've dedicated to researching this. The fact that you as a Sangha do that is really beautiful because one of the most important things in cultivating wise speech is having companionship or right companionship on the spiritual path. And many of the teachers that I interviewed talked about the importance of being in the right environment to help you cultivate wise speech. I need to begin with a caveat. Number one, I'm not going to give what's commonly called a Dharma talk because I'm not a trained teacher. I'm just a practitioner like the rest of you. And also, this is really the first time that I'm talking about the research that I've done, so I hope you'll be patient with me. What I'd like to do this morning is share some of what I've learned about developing a practice of wise speech through the research that I've carried out. My dissertation is hundreds of pages long, and I don't want to be an academic drone here that really tries your patience. So, what was that? So I can't go into great detail. But I will share a little bit with you and leave time for questions at the end. By way of introduction, I would like to say that being in this area reminds me of another life I once led. In the early 70s, the peninsula was also my neck of the woods. And what happened was 2 years after returning from living in South America, I wound up going to graduate school at Stanford in Latin American Studies. But I was so immersed in my work on women in Latin America that I can't recall knowing anything about the Buddhist teachings at that time. I doubt I'd ever heard the words Vipassana or Metta. Some of the teachers had already started training in India, but I didn't know anything about the practice. I briefly engaged in Zen meditation when I lived in Santa Cruz, and that was probably around 1976, maybe 77. It didn't take hold of me. It wasn't until I went to India in 1981, and I had a complete reorientation in my work, and I went to do cross-cultural research on the healing arts. And that's when I went on my first 10-day retreat in India, and then on my next 10-day retreat in Sri Lanka. And that's what I've been doing ever since, being involved in the Theravada tradition. However, to do my research, I wanted to interview teachers from the Theravada tradition, from the Zen tradition, Mahayana tradition, and Vajrayana. And I also interviewed rabbis. I wound up doing my PhD in this area and looking at both Judaism and Buddhism because I wanted to learn more about my birth heritage and I wanted to learn more about my chosen spiritual path. And I thought it would be really interesting to do a study learning from teachers in both traditions. For those of you who don't know, in the Jewish tradition, there's no monasticism. And the rabbi is literally, the word literally means teacher. So we don't have monks or priests, but we have teachers. And the tradition is a householder one. Even though people might go to a synagogue to pray together, holiday rituals and carrying on the tradition are the responsibility of the family. And so I also wanted to learn about wise speech from people who have religious responsibility as teachers, but also are living a householder life. In looking at both Judaism and Buddhism, you would automatically think, well, these two traditions are so radically different, why would you even choose them? But it turns out that aside from theism and a few other fundamental differences, there's really a lot of agreement, particularly on how we should use words. There's tremendous agreement, and I was really happy to find this. I kept coming across something in the Talmud or the Torah. These are Jewish scripture. And then I'd find a similar kind of quote in the Nikayas, whether it was the Majjhima Nikaya or the Sutta Nipata or the Dhammapada. And it made me realize that, yes, maybe one tradition believes in a deity, in God, and another one is of a more impersonal nature. But when it comes to being a human being, there are a lot of similarities in how we should function in the world with each other. Probably all of you are familiar with the term right speech or wise speech, but in doing my dissertation, I used the word ethical speech because it seemed the most neutral for bridging two different spiritual traditions that use a variety of languages. It was really hard because there are Japanese terms for this, there are Tibetan terms, there are Pali terms, there are Thai terms, there are Hebrew terms, and so on. And it made it really hard to know what terms to use. If I used it from one language, then the other teachers wouldn't know what I was talking about. So I wound up using ethical speech to do this bridging. But as you probably know, the English words right and wrong do not necessarily convey what the Buddha meant. It's not about the difference between ethical and unethical or moral and immoral, because those terms are really more about oiling how a society functions, how to make things smooth in our interactions. But what the Buddha was talking about is the difference between the mundane and the super mundane. In other words, the kind of speech at that level is speech that will either lead me to liberation and the unconditioned, or will hinder me on the path. And this is true in both Judaism and Buddhism, although the goals are different. By the time I completed my interviews with all the teachers, I came to the conclusion that respectful speech is what they were all talking about with regard to their practice. As I sifted through their descriptions of the kind of speech to engage in, it struck me that each one was indicating that it's a matter of speaking in a way that respects the integrity not only of others, but also of ourselves. Hurting others with our words also hurts us and keeps us from experiencing the freedom from suffering that the Buddha's teaching aims for. Such integrity, the integrity that I'm talking about, comes from holding certain beliefs. In Buddhist language, we might consider the interconnectedness of all beings or the interdependent nature of being. Perhaps someone we have difficulty with was actually our parent or spouse or child in another lifetime. Perhaps we understand that we are all composed of the same elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and thus are no different than anyone else. In Jewish language, we might consider that we're all created in the divine image. We arise in the same way as anyone else, and we're all made up of the same stuff. Knowing this, if I speak ill to you, then I also speak ill to myself. Speaking respectfully of others is also speaking respectfully of myself. In Judaism, hurting someone created in God's image or behaving in an unholy manner is a kind of desecration. We are now at the beginning of the Jewish calendar year, which is 5,764. Tonight begins the last day of the high holiday services known as Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. I find it synchronistic that Gil asked me to speak today, though I assume he really didn't know the connection, the particular connection that I want to point out. What happens during Yom Kippur services is that the congregation, in unison, confesses in the plural we and asks forgiveness of God for transgressions. What's so interesting about this is that most of the transgressions have to do with speech. So part of the service is, we have sinned against you by misusing the gift of speech. Or we have sinned against you through offensive talk, or through empty confession, or through foolish talk, or through slander, or through gossip, and so on. And I bring this up because there was a point in my Buddhist journey when I realized there was a whole lot more to practice than sitting in meditation. I needed to better integrate into my daily life and into my relationships the practice that I was developing on the cushion. And what happened was a really unfortunate incident with a dear Dhamma friend. It was a very painful experience that woke me up to the need to focus on samavaccha, on right speech. I had put so much attention into sitting and going on retreat, and I realized I didn't know enough about this part of the practice. And if you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, it's not just about sati and samadhi, mindfulness and concentration. It's also about right speech, right bodily conduct, right livelihood. Fully one-third of the path is sila, or morality. And I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of teachers. Well, I soon saw that focusing on speech was not nearly as easy as sitting quietly in meditation. It was a pretty rude awakening. Conditioned patterns unexpectedly rear their heads, and I find myself having to apologize and trying to make things right. As you've probably experienced, we can't always mend what we've broken with our speech. You might have heard the following story about the power of speech, maybe from another teacher. In a small Eastern European town, they were known as shtetls, a man went through the community just slandering the rabbi. That would be like walking around and slandering one of the Dharma teachers or the Buddha. One day, feeling suddenly remorseful, he begged the rabbi for forgiveness and he offered to undergo any penance to make amends. He was really sorry for what he'd done. So the rabbi told him to go home and take a feather pillow, cut it open, and just scatter the feathers to the wind, and then come back and see him. The man did as he was told. He went back to the rabbi, and he said, "Am I now forgiven?" "Almost," came the response. "You just have to do one more thing. Go and gather all the feathers." "But that's impossible," the man protested. "The wind has already scattered them." "Precisely," the rabbi answered. "And although you truly wish to correct the evil you have done, it is as impossible to repair the damage done by your words as it is to recover the feathers." This was like a knife in my heart when I read this, thinking back to words that I had let out in such a way and knowing I could never take them back. So it's no wonder that I've always loved going on retreat. I feel safe in the silence. I know I won't blurt out something foolish or harmful, something I'll feel sorry for. I won't let feathers fly that I won't be able to gather up. And how often have I, or have you, sat in meditation, remembering and rueing verbal blunders? I think this step on the Noble Eightfold Path and this precept of refraining from unwise speech is growing in importance because we recognize how basic and pervasive speech is in our lives, especially compared to the time we put on the cushion. I assume that those of us who are serious about practice don't grossly violate the precepts. We're not out on the street murdering people. We're not holding up banks, getting drunk, and the rest. But I would guess that each of us is talking every day and sometimes carelessly. Even though we may not intend to do harm, somehow hurt can be a result of the words that we use. Or maybe it's just the tone of our voice. And if we're mindful of sensations in our own body, we might notice a twinge, a sinking, a tension, or some other kind of feeling, because what we say about others probably hurts us as well. I say this because even though I'm much more conscious than I used to be, I know how embarrassingly often I fall down in this area. Again, I'm not talking about gross violations like public deception on a grand scale. We read about in the newspaper every day. But what happens is we begin to see the small stuff more clearly. Deeply ingrained habits die hard. So perhaps what touched me most in the interviews that I did with the teachers was the humility of each one. Not one teacher I interviewed claimed perfection in speech. Everybody said, even though it does get easier, it's still a lifelong challenge. Each day you get up and you face it anew. I heard this even from teachers who are in their 80s. As one Tibetan Lama told me, so long as we're in the human body, many mistakes. Many mistakes. I remember reading that my hero, the Dalai Lama, he gets angry and chews someone out occasionally too, but then he immediately regrets it and goes and apologizes. And I thought, okay, at least I'm in good company. So you might wonder why I give this example, why I would even point this out about the Dalai Lama. Not completely idealizing one of my spiritual heroes has become important in my own spiritual unfolding. The teacher's humility was like a gentle rain of compassion on my self-judgment. It didn't mean I could now pay less attention. Rather, it meant I could ease up on myself in terms of harsh criticism for not perfecting wise speech quickly. For some reason, I thought, okay, I'm going to focus on this. This is a big part of my practice now. Really going to give it a lot of attention. I must have thought that, like, in a week, suddenly I wouldn't ever blunder verbally. And, of course, that didn't happen. So interviewing these teachers really helped a lot. And I refer to this issue because it's a major one among Westerners, or at least among North Americans. Some of you may remember there was a conference in which the Dalai Lama spoke with Western teachers and psychologists. He was incredulous and visibly dismayed when he learned how much negativity or hatred we directed ourselves. If I recall correctly, the translator had difficulty translating the concept of low self-esteem or self-hatred, since it doesn't seem to exist in Tibetan. So I bring this up because please don't use slow progress in wise speech as one more thing to hold against yourself. Although I learned a great deal about specific strategies that I could use in cultivating respectful speech, I think this particular acknowledgement by each teacher has affected me more deeply than learning about any technique. The specific research question of my dissertation is, how do we transform our ordinary way of talking into a spiritual practice of ethical speech? In other words, what do we need to know and do to turn blah, blah, blah every day into verbal activity that reflects our deepest aspirations in the Dharma? When I started the project, even after so many years of meditation, I naively thought I would come up with a clear-cut list of tools with which I would then expeditiously repair all my own faulty speech habits. What I quickly learned is that in a spiritual enterprise, just as in healthcare, there is no magic formula. It's not that the teachers didn't share the strategies they've used. It's that such techniques represent only one aspect of the overall process of transformation. I also assumed, as I said, that the teachers skilled in ethical speech might not find it such a challenge after decades of practice. But if I had any notions of effortlessness in achieving speech ethics, they disencumbered me of such fantasies. Transformation doesn't happen overnight. Humble about their level of personal accomplishment, the teachers talked about a lifetime process. And I breathed a sigh of relief when they said this. The teachers shared with me their earliest painful and or positive experiences regarding the power of speech. I learned about their family environments, models in their communities, and their religious education. I asked about major turning points causing them to embrace speech as practice. There were similarities and differences among the teachers in each group, and of course also between the two groups. And it wasn't that these exemplars of respectful speech all started off with positive models to emulate. For some of them, it was just the opposite. Negative role models eventually spurred them on to learn how to communicate in a different way. And ever since then, they've been working on overcoming the early conditioning that was already embedded in their behavior. This was also a real boon to me because I thought, well, anybody who is so gracious and so kind and so perfect in their speech must have had wonderful models when they were growing up. But one Zen Roshi that I interviewed described his parents to me and how much he had to overcome. And that, too, was very heartening. And there were others who described their parents and grandparents as the most kind and loving people who never had a bad word to say about anyone. Several writers that I read talk about the dual purpose. Oh, excuse me. I want to talk about something else first. Some of the teachers began their religious training within the first 5 years of age. So, for example, the Tibetan Lama was sent to a monastery at a very young age, and Orthodox rabbis started their training at 4 or 5 years old. So they've had a long time of participating in a strict round of prayer or chanting and study day in and day out. And this had a lasting impact on them. There's a lot to be said for repetition of discipline in influencing our personality. If we hold to the precepts, our character forms in one way. If we don't, it forms in another direction. And several of the writers that I read talk about the purpose of following these behavioral guidelines, whether they're the precepts or the commandments. Yes, they do help to maintain a civilized society, but they also stimulate humaneness to flourish in all situations. The precepts help to purify and refine us over time. An ancient Jewish sage said, "Hasten to fulfill even a light precept and flee from all sin. For one good deed generates another good deed." Or we could say one kind word generates another kind word. So it becomes a question of what we make a commitment to. The Dhammapada suggests Better than 1,000 useless words is one single word that gives peace. Those teachers who did not start with a rigorous religious education that really inculcates strong self-discipline have applied a variety of strategies to control their impulses. In some cases, it's as simple as counting from 1 to 10 before they say anything. One Vipassana teacher told me that after realizing how much his temper tantrums led to suffering, his own and his family's, at the age of 11 or 12, before he knew anything about mindfulness practice, he thought to himself, okay, when these feelings come up, before I explode, just count to 10, count to 10, count to 10. And later he was able to do extraordinary things from that early practice. Also remember hearing, or maybe I read, that Thich Nhat Hanh suggests that we pause when the telephone rings. Instead of rushing immediately to pick up the phone, just pause, take a breath, and then answer the phone. And that pause gives us a chance to come back to the present and be mindful in the conversation. One rabbi recommends creating easy, small tidbits of practice by picking a block of time and designating it as inviolate for speaking anything that would hurt someone, whether it's slander, gossip, a lie, or so on. And then you gradually increase the amount of time, the way an athlete would do the same thing in preparation for a marathon. This rabbi described the trick or strategy for developing ethical speech is not any different than what we might do to change our eating habits. He said, if you tell yourself that you'll never have chocolate the rest of your life, you'll have an immediate craving for chocolate. If you tell yourself, I'm not going to eat chocolate for an hour, that's a manageable decision, and then you can renew it. So if we have a tendency, for example, to talk about others when they're not present, we can decide to set a time when we don't do that and just see what happens. It may feel so good that we want to continue it for longer and longer periods. One thing I started some weeks ago is setting the intention in my morning meditation to not interrupt. I remind myself to not interrupt. At the beginning, this was especially toward my husband. I don't know, maybe this is a handicap of being in a long-term relationship, that you think you know what your partner is going to say, and so you say it for them. And so he used to joke about my putting words in his mouth before he had a chance to let them out on his own. So I started practicing this, and gradually I expanded the intention to include others. And although it's a little bit different, it wasn't blocks of time, it was similar in that I was increasing gradually, and I just noticed how good I felt when I stopped myself. My husband hasn't seemed to notice yet, and I keep wanting to say, honey, have you noticed I haven't been interrupting you? But I thought, no, just be patient and see. And it really has been feeling good as I've expanded it and try to catch myself in conversation. No, it's not just about, I need to say something. This interjection is so important. It's really like, is what I have to say so crucial to the conversation? I mean, is it really? Or is this just a gesture of self-making? You know, I have to put me in there, whatever the conversation is. Joseph, in his last book, One Dharma, he calls this self-referencing, bringing conversations around so they're always about me. One monk told me that what helped him the most, a Theravada monk, that what helped him most in this regard was the built-in structure of monastic life and its requisite discipline. It imposed on him the restraint he hadn't been able to muster on his own as a young man. He's loquacious, is a good way to put it. And he had no restraints at all when he was a lot younger in talking. Because talking, being very nimble and agile in talking, really got him a lot of points in life. as he explained to me. But when he was a junior monk in this Thai monastery, and he was on a lower rung in the hierarchy of the monastery, he was limited in how much he was supposed to speak. So he said, the teacher does most of the talking, and you don't chime in. You learn to keep your mouth shut and sit there. He found this enormously helpful in what he called developing the breaks, the actual physical ability to realize I didn't have to express every single thought that went through my mind. Then I remember what one Zen teacher shared with me about interruption. Using speech as her lens, she examined all the 16 precepts or vows that she took in her Zen school. For example, she said, not killing means speaking in such a way that respects the life of the conversation. Interrupting is a form of killing speech. Not taking what is not given means not taking the floor when we don't have it. Not taking status or power when we don't have it through shading the truth. Not misusing sexuality could also be not misusing the intimacy of speech, not creating a false intimacy with speech. Not intoxication means not indulging in speech, and so on. This is really an easy exercise that any of us can do. You take each precept and apply it to the act of speaking. It really can open our understanding of what it means to kill with words, which unfortunately can be used like weapons. There's a Jewish proverb that likens a word to an arrow that goes straight into the heart. And there's also, in the Sutta Nipata, it says, to every person that is born, an axe is born in his or her mouth, by which the fool cuts himself or herself when speaking bad language. So what does it mean to take or steal with words? What does it mean to engage in sexual misconduct with words? And how do we intoxicate ourselves with excessive talking? Behavioral psychology points out many means for modifying our behavior, and the teachers I interviewed used a variety of them. If you read the suttas, the Buddha recommends a whole host of them. Similarly, there's an entire genre of Jewish ethical literature that makes suggestions for how to overcome unwholesome conduct and then get back on the holy path. I'll share some strategies that teachers used, though they don't necessarily reflect ancient texts. For example, you can use visual aids. One monk pinned a notice on the wall of his kuti, his hermitage hut, and it said, Samavacha, Samavacha, and then in big caps, Samavacha, to remind him every time because he's the one, the loquacious monk, who had so much trouble with talking. One rabbi remembers that when she was a teenager, she drew inspiration and comfort from a big poster of the, you remember the Desiderata poem that was around for a while? So she put this big poster on her bedroom wall, and the part that really spoke to her was the line that goes like this, go placidly among the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. Another rabbi put pieces of teachings from various sources on her dashboard, probably little post-it notes. Some teachers used writing to help them sort things through. One Zen teacher said she recorded interactions that she had with people, interactions that turned out differently than she thought that they would. So she studied these to try to understand what happened and then do otherwise next time. One rabbi recommended writing letters as a way to release the emotions of a difficult situation. But the caveat is to destroy them before venting. Excuse me. To destroy the letter after you vent it on paper. Or you could do it on your computer. You don't even have to have it on paper. That delete button. No more venting. For others, reading certain texts is helpful in cultivating respectful speech. I found this helpful myself. Studying scripture reinforces the teachings. A passage may serve to inspire, remind, or clarify. In one book, I read something that could easily apply to Buddhist literature as well. The authors write, ultimately, the goal of all of Jewish ethical literature is not merely to intellectually inform, but to spiritually transform its reader, not to win intellectual assent, but to alter ethical behavior, not to construct a literature structure, but to offer guidance in how to create one's life as a work of art. I'm in it's called the Majima Express, and we meet every month reading suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, and I'm finding that very helpful and very supportive. I don't know if you have a reading group here, but that's something you might want to try. Some of the teachers also cited the writings of contemporary masters and scholars, as well as popular literature on effective communication skills. One Zen teacher told me about a book called, I went out and bought it, it's called People Skills. I believe it's Robert Bolton. Some of us are more visually oriented. Some people are more successful with audio learning. Everybody has a different learning style, so it's, of course, up to each one of us to find out how we can learn most effectively. Personally, my orientation is kinesthetic. So even if I see something or hear something, I need to take notes. I need to have my body engaged in some way. I find the body an incredibly useful tool in evolving practice of right speech. And maybe it's because I'm kinesthetically oriented, but I learned a lot from the teachers about this too. We can turn to what I call the body's wisdom to help us in this, to serve us. Several of the teachers and my own experience confirmed this. They talked about visceral feedback alerting them to unwise or unethical speech. One rabbi said her whole body tenses up if she begins to talk about someone in a derogatory way. She compared the feeling to what happens to a dog who walks over to a certain boundary and an invisible shock gets him. You know those invisible fences? Like the dog, she immediately backs off. She also avoids listening to gossip because it makes her feel dirty, as though she's in the mud. She said that even little lies give her an allergic reaction spiritually. She prefers feeling lighter to feeling weighted down, as though pulled to a negative place by gravity when talk is filled with pessimism, negativity, or blame. A Zen teacher, he's a senior Roshi, bluntly said about engaging in unwise speech, "I feel shitty." I was a little shocked when he said this, but I feel shitty. I don't feel good about myself at all. And that's what keeps him from engaging in it. He just can't stand the feeling in his own body. Another rabbi also refers to feeling yucky, dirty, or crappy if she falls into speech that she senses is off the mark. She said to me, "At one moment, there might be a pleasure in it, but it just really doesn't feel good, like if you've had too much chocolate." So she looks to her body for feedback. Overindulgence in speech is something that she feels in her belly. But warnings before speaking come as a sensation of heaviness in her chest cavity. So these are her warning signals. As soon as she senses it, she knows it's time to put the brakes on and stop, or at least announce the intention to stop. One Vipassana teacher told me, "It's as though a little mindfulness bell goes off, like a warning bell, and he feels a slight unease in the moment." So each of us can find what that sensation is that is like a warning bell. One rabbi said that when he has inadvertently spoken unwisely, he immediately feels badly, and although it's not to the extreme of nausea or dizziness, he describes it as a feeling of emptiness and disappointment, and it's a pretty thoroughgoing visceral thing. Another Zen teacher said that when she was embarrassed that her verbal habits went in the opposite direction of the precepts, each one would strike her as a pang, as if somebody had snapped a rubber band at her heart or her stomach. And she would feel shame and remorse. And this, for her, was the main transformative tool. Feeling that over and over again in her body, and the shame and remorse that came with it, helped her change her ways. A Theravada monk said to me, "You want to see those little flickers and fluctuations and murmurings of the heart, noticing when something is a little bit out of balance, and then adjusting to that." This kind of internal feedback had an enormous impact on his process of transforming speech. He remembers his teachers in Thailand encouraging him to see the results of actions immediately and to be informed by that, to listen to that, to attend to that. So when you get that uneasy feeling, instead of saying, "Oh, it's nothing," pay attention. Just have a little more. When you begin to notice these warning signals, what can happen is, one rabbi told me that before she speaks and while she's listening, if something arises in her that she wants to share, or as another person begins to share something with her, she checks in with herself. Is this something that should be shared? In other words, will this be constructive or will this be destructive? The Theravada teachers pointed out that the combination of mindfulness and loving kindness is the key to success in developing a right practice of right speech. As one said, it takes mindfulness to see that speech is conditioned. It is the tool for seeing when the impulse to wrong speech is coming. But we also have to strengthen the feelings of metta, because when that's your basic intention or motivation, you don't want to do harmful speech. Over and over, I heard about motivation as the force behind maintaining a practice of respectful speech. As one Zen teacher said, to settle on a diet of right speech means to find one's deep motivation. To have right speech as part of one's life, one has to really want to express oneself that way. And then one has to be willing to let go of unwholesome conceptions. Other teachers put it in different terms. For example, one teacher called it a very simple equation. I don't want to suffer. I also don't want other people to suffer. The more I practice, the more the better life gets for me and everyone else. So there's less suffering. Or the equation could be expressed in the opposite term of happiness, our personal happiness, as well as the establishment of happiness in others. One Roshi said that what awakened his resolve to dedicate himself to what he calls upright speech is the fact that this is a very, very fleeting life, and we're all in it together, and everybody is infinitely precious and sacred. Knowing this, he says he can't survive. He can't live with himself unless he does it. As I said, my dissertation is hundreds of pages long, and so there's a whole lot more I could share, but my time is up. I think I'm over time. So I'd like to end with one last thing about the body's role in our practice of speech. I was very glad when several of the women teachers I interviewed talked about this, because it's a strong experience that I've had for a long time. And it's so obvious, you may wonder why I even mention it, but I bring it up because too often we ignore how essential our physical well-being is to our spiritual well-being. I came back from vacation a week ago. It's the first time I'd had a break in a really long time after finishing my dissertation. And during my time away, I noticed yet again the effect on my practice of right speech. Being more relaxed and moving through a less intense environment. I was up in British Columbia. I was better able to carry out my intentions. I was more sensitive to other people's speech, and I was more aware when judgment was arising in me, but not having to act on it. How I feel in my body, how much rest and exercise I get, whether I have adequate food often enough, and I don't run around and overschedule myself, and I keep to my daily sitting, it makes a huge difference in how successful I am in being conscious in communication. The Buddha talked about looking after the body's needs so we can practice. The Jewish philosopher Maimonides wrote a great deal about self-care and balance. Remember, too, that the Buddha's instruction for metta was very clear. First, we direct loving kindness at ourselves. I'd like to suggest that we take this to heart on the physical level as well and see what happens. What happens to our practice of right speech when we've gotten enough sleep and nutrition and exercise? What happens when we don't stress ourselves to the point of headaches and exhaustion? Do we find ourselves responding more mindfully and compassionately? Are we more likely to restrain ourselves from saying what we'll be sorry for? What happens when we organize our lives in such a way that it's truly easier to be kind because first we were kind to our own body? I hope that you'll be able to take at least one thing from the wisdom of the teachers I interviewed. May it help you in deepening your own speech conduct so that it reflects your highest goals in following the Buddha's teaching. And don't hesitate to create your own tools or techniques. Experiment and find out what's most effective for you. There are index cards that got passed out. I invite you to write down an intention that you have about your speech practice. You can carry it with you in your purse or your wallet. You could put it on your refrigerator or mirror. You could scotch tape it to your dashboard or set it by your zafu to look at after your sitting. Put it wherever it can serve as a reminder to help you reduce suffering and increase peace and kindness in your life and in the life of other beings. Thank you so much for your very kind and patient attention. If there are questions, I'm happy to stay and, to the best of my ability, answer them.